Well, peace be with you. Well, today we continue and bring to a close our series on the book of Esther. It's been a fascinating book, fascinating journey. We're going through chapters 8 and 9 today, and a major theme, of course, is providence. And providence is really the invisible hand of God guiding, directing, providing for his people through the ups and downs of life. And one of the kind of the tensions that we've been holding together through this, or not a tension so much, is kind of a point of interest that we need to highlight in our own minds and thinkings is, you know, sometimes we think something is coincidence when it's really just providence. This is God invisibly working in our lives. And I came across this quote that's anonymous. A coincidence is a miracle in which God prefers to remain anonymous. I really like that. I know some of you have heard that. It's a pretty famous one. A coincidence is a miracle in which God prefers to remain anonymous. Anonymous. I like that. Now, it's easy to believe in providence when everything is going great, when you're just, you know, things are coming up roses and you're finding tokens on the way to the subway, right? It's more difficult to believe in providence when things are hard and they are messy and they are painful and difficult and things aren't going as you had planned in your life. But can we trust that God is a God of providence during those moments? Take the example of William Tyndale, famous figure from Christian history. So Tyndale was born in the 1400s, came to believe in God, he was a Christian, and he fell in love with the Bible. And he really had this passion, like he became a scholar, and so he could, you know, read Greek and he could translate. And so really his English countrymen and countrywomen to actually be able to have a New Testament in their own language, because that wasn't the case at the time. And in fact, it was illegal to translate the Bible into English at that point in time. And so he made this translation, which is a huge work of the New Testament. He tries to find someone in England to make copies. No one will. He travels to Germany. Finally, he finds someone. They produce several thousand copies. They get them back into England by smuggling them in bales of cloth on a ship. When they get back to England in the harbor, it's discovered. There's this massive book burning of English Bible translations in London. It's this huge thing. And then in 1530, his translation was condemned, he was captured, imprisoned, he was put on trial for heresy, found guilty, and sentenced to execution, all for his translation work of the Bible into English. And so this is a picture of Tyndale. This is of his execution. And so this is in 1536. It's a woodcut from Fox's Book of Martyrs. And so he's up there, and it's he's going to be publicly burned. So the idea, and this was common for heretics, and you know, there's you know, you can see kind of the kindling and the stuff that's going to flame, and it will consume his body. It's a horrific way to die. And actually, the executioner, right before they set the flames, actually strangled him to death in an act of mercy, because he thought it would be better and less painful to die by strangulation than by the flames consuming your flesh. And so he did this as an act of mercy, and Tyndale died, 1536. The very next year, English Bibles were being sold openly and publicly in England. How crazy is that? Okay, the very next year, and all this work, and perhaps the most well-known, influential English translation of the Bible is called the King James Version. It's the these and the thous that some of us, would have grown up with. Much of that translation work is actually based on the earlier work of Tyndale. And so, wow, can we trust that God is working, that he is bringing his good purposes to fruition even through those sorts of dark episodes in life? So this is what we're going to explore as we continue through the book of Esther, not only how it happens in the story, but thinking about how that might apply to our own lives. So here's our trajectory today. We're going to go through chapters 9 and 10. I'm going to comment on how this story does or doesn't relate to the current war between Hamas and Israel. Now, why would we do that? Because as we go through the story, I know that some of you have been thinking, okay, Jews, conflict, war, is this somehow connected to the book? So I'll make comment on that. And then what we're going to do is we're going to bring it all to a close with a final word about God's providence in our lives, especially when it's maybe difficult to see and perceive. Recall that throughout the entire book, the name of God is not mentioned once. There is no overt miracle, not even one. And so how do we see God working even through the messy circumstances of life? So, okay, here's a recap of where we've been so far in case you've missed a Sunday or two. So we hit the ground running. The story begins in the Persian court with King Ahasuerus. After a surely torturous, difficult process, Esther, who's a young Jewish woman, is promoted to queen. The king made a law that people should bow to Haman, Turns out the ancestors of Haman and Mordecai, who is Esther's adoptive father, were enemies, so Mordecai refuses to bow. Haman devises a plot to kill not only Haman, but all Jews. Esther risked her life to persuade the king to change the law. The king remembers that Mordecai once saved his life, wants to reward him. At the same time, Haman becomes more enraged with Mordecai, builds a huge pole on which to impale him. Esther reveals that Haman has devised a plot to kill her and her people. The king, in a rage, has Haman impaled on the 75-foot pole that he had constructed to kill Mordecai. Since the annihilation order for the Jews cannot be revoked, a new law is passed that the Jews can defend themselves against their attackers, and the day is set. And so the tables are starting to turn. The Jewish people are happy that they are not just lambs left defenseless for the slaughter. And so clearly things are quite messy in this story, but ours is a God of the trenches. And so let's find out what will happen. So we're going to start, turn to Esther 9, and then chapter 10 we're going to go through as well, but it's only a couple of verses. And so I'm reading from the ESV. Now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on that very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. Right? So this is one of the many reversals. You know, Esther, Mordecai, and now this day of attack. By the way, the day would have been March 7th, 473 B.C., the Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. Right? Mordecai is gaining in power and influence. For Mordecai was great in the house, the king's house, and his fame spread throughout the provinces. For the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing, destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel, so that's the capital city, in Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. And remember, this is all self-defense, right? So they can't just go willy-nilly. It has to be people who are consciously attacking they, women, and children and seeking plunder. They're allowed to exercise self-defense. And they also killed Parashadatha and Dalphon and Aspatha and Paratha and Adaliah and Aradatha and Parmashta and Arisai and Aradai and Vizatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, but they laid no hand on the plunder. Pause for a second. By the way, if you read through the Bible and you come across names, you're like, I'm not sure how this is going to go. The same is true for the pastor. I had to practice those names like 10 times to make sure. I still might have gotten them wrong. If anyone knows biblical Hebrew, they might be able to correct me. Anyway, so a couple of things about this. This is very interesting. So these names. So Haman, these are his sons. Remember, he was second in command. And so there would have been a lot of people in the city who had loyalty to Haman and to his family. He was very powerful and influential. A scholar in her commentary on Esther named Karen Jobs, she says that these names of his sons might actually be what is called Daiva names. And what is that? In ancient Persian culture, these names might have been connected to demonic powers. So if that is true, the idea here is that, wait a second, Haman and his family might actually be agents of the evil one in an attack against God's people, if that is true. Now, it's interesting that, not only that, but in the Hebrew manuscript, something really is interesting when you look at them here. Those names of the sons are actually written off in the side, in the column. Now, keep that in mind. Keep also in mind at the end of verse 10, it talks about how they laid no hand on the plunder. Now, according to the law that Mordecai had brought in, they could do that. They actually could lay hands on the plunder. So given the fact that these names might be Daiva names connected to ancient demonic powers, given the fact that, you know, these words are written in the margin, perhaps suggesting that there would be these names and people were to be set totally aside for destruction, and the fact that they don't touch the plunder, which in itself is one of the ancient rules for holy war. It may be, because God's people are not to profit, right, in situations like this. It may be the case that God's people, Esther, Mordecai, and everyone else, considered their self-defense to be an act of holy war. That might have been what's in their mind. Verse 11, that very day, the number of those killed in Susa the citadel was reported to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, in Susa the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your wish? It shall be granted to you, and what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled. And Esther said, if it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict, and let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. Hanging a rival and their family on gallows was actually common practice to warn people who might have been loyal to them. So the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa, but they laid no hands on the plunder. Okay, so some people at this point kind of feel a bit ambiguous about what Esther has done. She's requested another day of killing, of self-defense, at least in the capital city in Susa. So what's going on? Some people thought, well, maybe power is going to her head. But I think another explanation, this is another theory of thought here, is that actually Esther is actually kind of coming into her own as a woman of wisdom because she realizes, wait a second, we're here in the capital city. This is where most of everything significant happens. Haman's got all these family. There's people who are loyal to him. There's one day isn't enough. And so there's going to be more people coming at us tomorrow. And it turns out she was right. So the very next day, after the first day of self-defense, on the second day, 300 more people come at them, and they are put down as well. It also says they laid no hands on the plunder. Oh, sorry, we'll get to that in verse 16. Okay, so now the rest of the Jews, verse 16, who were in the king's provinces, also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but they laid no hands on the plunder. That's a lot of people. 75,000. Now, what does this tell us? We should know what proportion this is of the population at large. So in the ancient Persian Empire, scholars suggest it's probably around 50 million people, okay? So it's pretty big, and so what does 75,000 represent? 0.0015, so, you know, less than a fifth of 1%, you know, or about a fifth of 1%. So it's a small amount. It's still significant, right? But we're also to see in this, I think, the extent of the anti-Semitism, what we would call today anti-Semitism, right? They're allowed to defend themselves, and so we know that Mordecai is rising. Even still, 75,000 people come at them. Notice that this is the third time that we've been told that they laid no hands on the plunder, so they're not seeking to profit from this. Verse 17, this was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made that day a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th and rested on the 15th day, making that a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who live in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day of gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. So this explains the kind of the difference in kind of the length of celebration and the dates. Verse 20, and Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that they had been turned for them, that had turned for them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. And so on this feast that's being described of their deliverance, Purim, they're giving gifts. And so that often happens in celebrations, right? One of the things that characterizes Christmas is giving of gifts, especially to people who maybe don't have that much. Verse 23, so the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to... Oh, sorry. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King... Wait, where am I? Okay, sorry, verse 23. You're getting messed up. Sorry about that back there, Louise. Verse 23. So the Jews accepted what they had been started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast Pur, that is lots, to crush and to destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, they called these days Purim, after the term poor. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter, and of what they had faced in this matter, and of what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation in every clan, province, city, that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. All right, and so for Jewish people, this festival continues to this day. Verse 29, then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew gave full written authority confirming this second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus in words of peace and truth. Now, these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them, and as they had obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fasts and their lamenting. The command of Esther confirmed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing. So here, these times and dates and celebrations, they're confirmed by Esther, which shows to us she has grown significantly in authority. Chapter 10, King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea. And all the acts of his power and might and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. And so the book ends there, but it's interesting also, remember that Mordecai himself has been elevated by none other than Esther. And so those words could be applied to her as well. For she sought the welfare of her people and spoke peace to all her people. And so with that, we end the book of Esther. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Okay, so as mentioned, I want to, before we get on to the particular application of this to our lives today, I want to comment on how this story does or doesn't relate to the current war between Hamas and Israel. And the reason I want to do this is because I know that some of you have been wondering as we go through this, and it makes sense when you look at the text and the story and global events. Okay, is there any, you know, Jews and war, like what, does this have anything to do with that? And so let me share some comments. And I know that for some people, these can be challenging issues and topics and controversial. It's hard to know what's going on. And so I'm going to share these thoughts. If you have questions or follow-up, I encourage you to talk to me afterwards. But I hope that this is helpful. So Hamas and Israel have struggled against one another for recognition, safety, a place to call home. Recognition, safety, and a place to call home. So who is Hamas? So Hamas is a political party in the Gaza Strip who came to power and are considered by many nations, including this one, to be a terrorist organization. Okay? They're a spinoff of the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, who is a militant group. And so they do actually govern a couple million people in the Gaza Strip. They are known for violently trying to eliminate Israel. And they will use suicide bombers and missiles and innocent targets as well. So in October 2023, you will remember from the news that Hamas launched a surprise attack on innocent Israelis, which was the deadliest attack in modern Israeli history. Innocents, including women and children, and the horror of what happened to those innocent people is virtually indescribable. And we need to call it, I certainly do, evil. Okay. Now, one of the things that has happened in modern discourse is a radical oversimplification. One of those radical oversimplifications is to say that Hamas are courageous freedom fighters for oppressed Palestinians against the ultimate oppressor, the big bad Israel. This is abjectly untrue. I and many others and many of you strongly condemn terrorism and those who purposely seek to attack innocents. Okay. Now next, who is Israel? Well, it's easy to think that Israel, the Israel that exists today, is the same as the Israel who existed in the Bible. Now granted, there was a nation that came to power under Saul, David, Solomon, came to be called Israel. That nation, as it existed then, didn't last, and the lands came under control of many different groups and powers over the past couple of thousand years. The modern state of Israel began in 1948. A major theme in its history has been some of this ongoing conflict around these issues. But we need to remember that the modern state of Israel is not exactly parallel with the Israel in the Bible. It is an oversimplification to say that. So in the Bible, through Abraham and his descendants, and then through Judah and Israel, that is God's instrument to bless the world. Now what we need to see today is that Jesus Christ, as the long-awaited Messiah of God's people, he is the fulfillment of those promises. So the agent through which the nations and peoples of the world are blessed is Jesus Christ. And it's important for us to recognize that, because some Christians, they think, well, you know, everything that the current state of Israel, this is the fulfillment of all these promises from the Old Testament, and that's the source of blessing. We need to understand that Christ himself is the fulfillment and blessing through those Old Testament covenant promises. After the October attacks, Israel declared war on Hamas, and it is within its right to do so. I and many others, however, have concern that Israel needs to observe the rules of war and do their best to avoid civilian casualties. And I think when that happens, when there are civilian casualties on either side, it should be something that seriously and significantly grieves our hearts. Further, to complicate a situation that's already difficult to understand, not all Palestinians are Muslims. There are many Palestinians, actually, who are Christians as well. Not only that, but not all Palestinians actually support what their terrorist leaders, Hamas, are doing. Even in the midst of all this, there is a rise of anti-Semitism in this world, and I think we need to acknowledge that, particularly in pop culture, in Western countries like ours, including on our own university campuses, something which should be alarming. So the entire situation is complex. It's hard to get information as well about what's going on. We also need to acknowledge that we are being flooded with digital propaganda on this stuff all the time. And so just clicking a few websites here and there is not really adequate to try to find out what is happening. In short, we need to remember that, and here's where we're kind of driving to, the modern conflict that we are experiencing in the world is separate from the story of Esther. It's separate from the story of Esther. Perhaps the biggest similarity is the rise in anti-Semitism. Even still, terrorism is evil. Hamas is evil. Israel as a country can, like any other, defend itself, but it needs to ensure it's protecting innocent life and not overreach. The killing of innocent people on either side is a symptom of the sin and brokenness which has plagued our creation and world since the Garden of Eden. For all people, regardless of who they are made in the image of God and are given dignity and respect. So I think a helpful focus for us as people who follow Christ and strive for his ways is what he says in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. Karen Jobs comments on God's strategy when it comes to holy war. God's strategy when it comes to holy war. This is a good summary statement. God's strategy against sin and evil was awaiting the perfect warrior who could execute divine justice with clean hands and a pure heart. His name is Jesus. And so the only one equipped in our time to execute holy war is Jesus. So there's a lot there. If you have questions, follow up. But I want to, having said that, I thought it was important in the context of this series to say some of those things. And having said that, let's kind of shift back over and kind of bring the series as a whole to a close with a final word about God's providence in our lives. So when we started this, I said that one of the main motivations for the book was about providence, right? Can we see when the name of God is not mentioned, when no overt miracle happens, can we see the hand of God at work specifically for these people in this story? Because these are Jews, remember, they didn't go back after the exile. They didn't go back to their homeland. They didn't go back to Jerusalem. They're not rebuilding the temple. And surely they had a series of questions. Are we still God's people? Has he abandoned us because we didn't return with the others? Is he watching over us, and even as we live among people who don't share our customs and beliefs, is he still saving us? So part of the function of the story and the book is to answer those questions with an emphatic yes. And so part of the application for us today is, okay, for us, can we see where and when God is working, even when his name is not mentioned, because we can relate to that, even when things seem broken, even when we don't see overt miracles? And the answer for us is also, as we read the story, an emphatic yes. Part of the reason is because we honor a God of providence who is sovereign. A church father named Ignatius had this great word. He said, God uses crooked sticks to draw straight lines. Now, what does that mean? It means God uses what is imperfect and broken to achieve his perfect purposes. What is imperfect and broken to achieve his perfect purposes. This is part of his incredible sovereign providence. Look at these examples from the book of Esther. Miles and miles from home, a situation which is surely imperfect and broken, God drew a straight line from their experiences to his faithful promises. They were living amongst people who didn't share their beliefs or customs, right? That is an imperfect and broken situation, and yet God draws a straight line from that right to his own faithfulness. Or we could look at the situation. They're facing an annihilation order of destruction and danger and fear. That is an imperfect and broken situation. And God draws a straight line from that to his salvation and to his rescue. God used crooked sticks to draw straight lines. So the same thing is true for us in our lives today. I just ask you, what in your life is imperfect? And this isn't a public forum, so don't yell anything out. You know what it is. What in your life is imperfect? What do you consider something in your life that is broken or painful? What was true for them is true for you. God uses crooked sticks to draw straight lines. In chapter 8, verse 15, God's people had light and gladness and joy and honor. Their God and ours is a God of rescue and salvation, a God of the trenches, a God who comes for, is with, rescues, redeems, lifts up his people. All of these promises are perfectly received in Israel's Messiah, Jesus Christ. Amen.